It was a very cruel scene, executed in an unusual manner.
Hey, Cruel Coven.
Hello, friends and foes.
I'm Tori.
I'm Katie.
Welcome to Cruel and Unusual,
the podcast.
Here we are.
We're here. Hello. How do you do? It's great to be back.
You guys, we have a really long boy for you today.
It's a long one. It's going to have to be split.
Two-parter.
Two parts.
And it also comes with many a trigger warning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they include sexual assault, kidnapping, and sexual abuse. There's probably other ones that kind of tie in there and go along there.
It's just, in general, a really rough case.
Yeah.
You ready to get started?
Okay, so Red Bluff, California is a quiet town. It isn't a town that you'd buy a postcard in or stop to see the sights in. When you think of California, a lot of us who aren't on the West Coast think of sunny beaches and warm sand. We think of traffic jams and high-end shopping centers. We think of the rich and the beautiful and a never-ending summer. But honestly, Red Bluff isn't any of those things. Not really, anyway. It's not the picturesque California that we all think about. Red Bluff, as I said, isn't a town that you'd go to if you were a tourist passing through. Red Bluff is home to the annual Red Bluff Roundup, which is essentially a rodeo and a bull sale with other festivities strewn about. And doesn't that just scream Midwest to you?
It really does. It sounds very rural.
Yeah.
Cornfieldish. It does sound like something that would happen here.
So I found an article that was updated in 2020, and it said that the population of Red Bluff has now grown to an estimated 14,710 people. However, it is only safer than 2% of U.S. cities.
And that's saying a lot with such a small population.
Yeah. I've started doing a little bit of a deep dive into this because it was so intriguing to me that such a small, in the grand scheme of things, small city could be so unsafe. In 2020, there were 144 violent crimes reported. There were 662 property crimes reported, totaling 806 reported crimes between those two segments. There was one reported murder, 33 reported and logged rapes, 26 robberies, and 84 assaults.
Wow.
Your chance of being involved in a violent crime in Red Bluff is 1 in 102 people, and your chance of being involved in a property crime in Red Bluff is 1 in 22. And the reason that I'm telling you all of this is because today we are going to be talking about the truly devastating, heartbreaking, brutal, sadistic attack on Colleen Stan. Now, before you guys start making fun of us and sending emails about how we're pronouncing her name wrong, I promise we're not. We originally, in the Midwest, it's most common to pronounce a name that is C-O-L-L-E-E-N, Colleen, but she says herself that it is pronounced Colleen.
Cameron Hooker seemed like a normal young boy, according to those who remember him. He was born in Alturas, California on November 5th of 1953 to his parents Harold and Lorena Hooker. His parents had moved to California from Arkansas in search of a better life. It's said that Harold and Lorena were simple and that they were not well-educated, and they struggled to make ends meet. They didn't have an easy life by any means. They moved around a lot after moving from Arkansas to California. It's reported that every 2 to 3 years they would up and move. We're not sure what the root cause of the moves were, but we do know that Harold worked in sawmills and in construction, and Lorena stayed home with Cameron and Dexter, Cameron's younger brother. There's no reported abuse or neglect by Harold and Lorena on their children, but moving around a lot and constantly switching from town to town and school to school isn't easy on a child, especially in impressionable and formative years. In the book Perfect Victim by Christine McGuire and Carla Norton, it's said that, quote, Cameron was generally quiet and kept to himself, though he was described as a happy kid in grammar school. He used to entertain the other children by pretending that he had a button in the middle of his back, and if anyone pressed it, he'd fall to the ground and play dead. It was a big hit during recess, especially with the giggling girls, end quote. Once Cameron was a teenager, his family had purchased property south of Red Bluff. This was in the year 1969, and Cameron was labeled as part of the Quad Squad, The Quad Squad were more or less determined to be outcasts, and they would hang out in certain areas on the school grounds. It's reported that Cameron didn't have close friends, and he wasn't active in school, opting not to play sports or join other teams or organizations. He wasn't a very quote-unquote good student either, and he had a hard time passing his classes. Cameron graduated from high school in 1972. He started working at the local lumber mill and was apparently having some very dark, forbidden thoughts. Ones that he would act out soon on an unsuspecting 15-year-old girl. One that he married. Janice, when she and Cameron Hooker met, was known as a quote-unquote naive and insecure girl. The book The Perfect Victim also described her with a, quote, personality less mature than her figure, end quote. She had frizzy brown hair and glasses. Janice was only in the ninth grade, so a high school freshman, when she and Cameron were introduced by a mutual friend. The two of them are said to have hit it off right away, and Janice viewed him as very different from the high school boys she was used to. After all, Cameron had a vehicle, he had a steady job, he was 19, and most of all, he was very, very nice to her. Janice had no idea that she was being groomed from the moment Cameron laid his eyes on her. She was in the ninth grade. She didn't even know what being groomed was, but Cameron had ulterior motives from the very beginning of their friendship. Janice and Cameron started hanging out, taking drives, and going out for meals together.
To give you some background on Janice, she was part of a family of six, and she was the youngest of four siblings. She would later go on to say that her parents were never very doting or loving parents, especially her father, who worked long hours. Her mother was described as strict and a mother who was very hands-off, at least when it came to Janice. It's reported that Janice was pawned off on her older sister, Lisa, who ended up raising her for the most part, taking care of her and teaching her the things that her parents should have been teaching her. One of the potential reasons that people have said Janice was just kind of like disregarded by her parents was because she was diagnosed with epilepsy when she was a child. She later said that it was her impression that her father thought that people who had epilepsy were, quote, possessed by demons, end quote.
That's so awful.
Disgusting. Janice would go on to later say that she felt neglected, unloved, and rejected. She felt like her parents disapproved of her. And she was told that she was stupid often, but never that she was loved. And that is so heartbreaking to me. Mm. Like, her parents went out of their way to call her names and call her stupid, but they never once could just be like, I love you, which clearly they didn't. Janice said, quote, no matter how good or rotten a guy was to me, I just kind of latched on to him. End quote, which is also just equally as heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot can be determined by that statement. So Janice grew up in a home where love wasn't an emotion shown to her. She felt constant neglect and even like that she was repulsive to her parents, who were like the first people who are supposed to love you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they should be the ones who are showing love and teaching what it means to give and take love, but not with Janice. Janice had never, ever, ever felt like she was a priority to anyone. So even when the men she was around were mean to her, at least they were giving her some kind of attention. And that is how she validated it in her brain.
That's so sad.
And this is very common aftermath in individuals who had felt emotional abuse or emotional traumas. And unfortunately, Janice had been conditioned to accept any kind of attention from a very young age. So when she met Cameron Hooker, after dealing with her parents and then dealing with mean men in her high school growing up, Cameron looked like this knight in shining armor to her, right? Like, he could save her. And she desperately wanted to be saved. So, as we said, Janice and Cameron began dating. Everything was all roses and butterflies and the gooey stuff that love is made out of. A few months into the relationship, a few months of grooming, that is, and Cameron finally let Janice in on one of his darkest fantasies. He told Janice that he wanted to suspend her by her wrists, hang her from a tree without any clothes on, and basically just have his way with her. When Cameron first told her of this fantasy of his, she was immediately taken back. She was not comfortable, but she couldn't say no, or she didn't feel like she could say no. In her brain, it felt like she couldn't say no.
Well, she didn't want to lose him.
Exactly. The first person to really show her any kind of attention, She couldn't go against what he wanted, or she risked that.
Right.
She later said she was, quote, the kind of person who just gave in so somebody would love me, end quote. Once again, her childhood trauma allowed her to settle for much less in all aspects of her life, not just her love life. And we're not saying that Cameron is less because he has dark fantasies or certain kinks. You'll see why soon. Anyway, so Janice agreed to his fantasy, although she didn't want to. She couldn't lose the man that loved her, finally, after years and years of being so neglected and unloved. So she agreed, and she let Cameron take her out into some nearby mountain land. And he strapped her into leather cuffs that were handmade, and he hung her up just as he told her that he would. Despite the fact that all Janice experienced during this ordeal was hurt and pain, once Cameron took her down from being suspended, he held her, he hugged her, and he was over the top affectionate and loving and just very elated, over the moon, visibly very happy and excited about what had just happened. He tended to her and made sure that she was okay.
And this became a regular outing for Janice and Cameron. And because of the way Cameron acted each time they were done, Janice felt like it was normal. She felt like she was in a position where she should be doing this, and it was making her partner happy, and she wanted so desperately to hold on to this man. So she kept doing it. Keep in mind, she's still a minor at this point, still in high school, still evolving and learning who she is and who she wants to be.
And he's a grown man at this point. Yep, he's 19. Yep.
She's being groomed during a time when she has more questions than answers about herself, about her body, and about everything going on around her. Being suspended from a tree out in the woods soon turned into other bondage types of activities. Cameron introduced whips. He beat her, but never in a way to leave a permanent mark or scar. He would purposely only take it as far as to leave welts on Janice's body because he didn't want evidence of what was going on to be left behind. And always, once Janice started begging to be let down, once she started begging for him to stop whipping her, he did. At one point, there was some kind of almost drowning episode that happened after Cameron confessed yet another dark fantasy of his. This time, he wanted to tie her up and dunk her in the creek. So whether that was some sort of, like, let's see how long she can hold her breath type of thing.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure, but it seems like something that he would do or you know, find thrilling based on the other things that he did.
Right. So he did. Something reportedly maybe went wrong and she almost drowned. It's believed that Janice did briefly think of leaving Cameron after this terrifying event, but that she was too ashamed and afraid and embarrassed to leave. She was so upset about the bondage acts, the whippings, and the dark fantasies that were being enacted on her, and she was too afraid and ashamed to tell her family. She also worried if she told her parents that they'd punish her, and she thought maybe they would make her stop seeing Cameron. It was this deep, dark catch-22 that she was just constantly circling in. She didn't have love from her parents, so she accepted quote-unquote love from an abuser who was nice to her sometimes, very heavily gaslighting her and grooming her, and a rapist because, let's remember, she was underage. The only time she felt comfortable or secure or loved was when she was with the man who abused her. And because she was so fearful of losing him, her abuser, she stayed. It's said that Janice romanticized the relationship. She often did everything she could to overlook the sexual desires that Cameron acted out on her, and she focused on the good times because there were times that Janice felt love. Cameron took her places she hadn't been before. He taught her how to snow ski and water ski. All the times he was kind and caring and good to her, that's what made it that much harder for her to take the next step to leave him. Ultimately, Janice and Cameron ended up getting married on January 18th, 1975. They were married in Reno, Nevada, and yes, you're doing the math right. Janice was only 16 when she was allowed to marry Cameron, who was 21 at the time. Janice was afraid her parents would make her wait until she was 18, like they made her sister wait, but they were more than ready and willing to pass Janice off to Cameron, despite the fact that their child was just that. A child. Janice and Cameron were given $500 in lieu of a big wedding ceremony, and they were sent off into the world together.
Janice ended up dropping out of school when she was still 16, and Cameron continued working his job at the local mill. The couple started off as most young couples do, to an extent, by way of having small funds and struggles. They were like most people. They moved into a duplex that was said to lack charm in any form of the word, and they had a, quote, shared cement alley for a front yard. During the first couple of years of marriage, Cameron's dark fantasies evolved yet again. He would choke Janice until she passed out, and he did several other things to her that I won't be talking about, but you can definitely find them online if you're interested in knowing the details. But for the safety of our listeners' mental health, I won't be going into deep detail about any of that. At some point, it's said that Cameron could no longer contain his sexual fantasies to having just one woman to do them with. He ended up confessing yet another fantasy to Janice. Quote, he wanted to bring a third person into the home, another woman who would submit to his sadomasochistic experiments, in his words, a girl who couldn't say no, end quote. And that is from The Perfect Victim, the book. Supposedly, Cameron kind of marketed, almost, this idea to Janice as this new woman would take the brunt of his deepest, darkest, most violent desires. He knew Janice was growing more and more tired and uncomfortable with his fantasies, and the way that he could get her to agree to bringing another woman into their home was to use this to his advantage. And eventually, Janice agreed to it. There were ways Cameron knew he could go about it. Using the underground papers that he read, he could place an ad if he wanted to, but those were expensive, and apparently a lot of the ads ran, and people accepting the advances were further away, so like near San Francisco, near that area. It was just too much fine print for Cameron. So instead of finding a willing participant, because there are definitely willing participants who are into this kind of thing, and he could have found one had he put even an ounce of effort into it, but he decided to do something completely and totally sadistic instead. Janice and Cameron talked logistics. If Janice could have a baby that she had desperately been longing for, then she would agree to give Cameron what he wanted. And he wanted to kidnap a woman to keep as his in-home, own personal, quote-unquote, sex slave. And that was the term that he used. Cameron was delighted when he got Janice to agree to the deal. He held up his end of the bargain, and the two became parents in 1976 when Janice gave birth to a healthy baby girl. He continued his preparations, which included constructing different torture devices, a rack that he could suspend this new woman on, the one that he would be kidnapping from. He even made what is now referred to as a head box, and the head box is described as having dual walls and large metal hinges. A lot of you will probably hear Colleen Stan's story referred to as the girl in the box.
Mm-hmm.
But Katie and I talked about it, and we decided that that's not what we were going to call this.
No. And
because she has a name.
She does. And there are other boxes involved. And I also wanted to throw in a trigger warning that I forgot about at the beginning for claustrophobia, because it's kind of bad.
Yeah.
So Cameron prepared and prepared, and he did his due diligence. And honestly, I can't help but wonder what type of life he could have had if he would have applied himself even half the way he applied himself to his little project he had going on. So we'll come back to Cameron and Janice Hooker in a little bit, but now we're going to talk about Colleen Stan. Colleen Stan and her family lived in Riverside, California. Her parents, Jack Martin and Evelyn Martin, decided to go their separate ways, and they divorced when Colleen was only 3 years old. Colleen was the oldest of three siblings, all girls, and her sisters' names were Janice and Bonnie Sue. It's said that her parents' divorce didn't completely tear apart the family like some do. In the book we used for research, it described Evelyn and Jack's divorce as, quote, the usual disruption that follows divorce was muted. Evelyn, Colleen's mother, was said to be friendly, chatty, and social. Colleen was reportedly mostly raised by her mom, but she did stay in touch and close to her father, Jack. Jack was quiet, and it's safe to say he and Evelyn were opposites in that way. He was more withdrawn and kept more to himself than being social in the way Evelyn was. Evelyn and Jack both remarried, and thus Colleen, Janice, and Bonnie Sue ended up having two half-sisters and a half-brother. As Colleen grew up, she was very close with Janice and Bonnie Sue. They played together and they had that treasured sister bond that so many covet. She ended up taking a liking to poetry and she was incredibly creative. She designed cards and wrote poems, giving the cards to friends and family members as gifts. It's said that she had a quote-unquote warm and dreamy side, and that's from the Perfect Victim book. Colleen didn't have dreams of going to college, and therefore she didn't take much interest in her academics. At 16 years old, she dropped out of high school and got married to a 22-year-old man named Tom Stan. Tom wasn't from Riverside, and there isn't a lot that is said about him in the book or any of the other research we did. They had only met a few months prior to the couple getting married in Carson City, Nevada, on the 12th of December in 1973. At this time, Colleen was 16 and Tom was 22. Colleen and Tom ended up moving to OHOP together, and not long after they started living together, problems arose. Within the next year, Colleen and Tom ended things, and Colleen moved back home to Riverside.
Once settled back in her old stomping grounds, she decided to take the high school equivalency exam, and she passed. She went through a few jobs, and she moved around, although she did stay in Riverside. She dated here and there, and at some point she formed a friendship with Bob and his partner, Alice Walsh. The couple had a 2-year-old son named Tomac, and it's said that the four of them almost formed like a makeshift family, despite the fact that Colleen had her own family. The couple lived in Eugene, Oregon, and eventually Colleen decided to move up there with them. On May 19th of 1977, Colleen, who was 20 at the time, was hitchhiking, and she was heading to a friend's house to surprise her for her birthday in Northern California. Hitchhiking was not uncommon then, and Colleen typically had a good read on people. There was an estimated 400 miles separating Colleen from her friend's place, and she knew that she had a long road ahead of her, literally, and she decided to hike down Interstate 5, which was known for having hitchhikers alongside of it. She reportedly rode with multiple people and had made it around 350 miles when Cameron and Janice Hooker, along with their 8-month-old baby, pulled up alongside of her in their blue Dodge Colts.
It kills me that she was so close to her destination.
Yep. She made it so far. 350 miles hitchhiking.
Unscathed until the last stretch.
So at this point in time, Cameron was 23 and Janice was 19. When Colleen saw the young couple with their baby, she felt safe. Like, this couple who was so close in age to her, it's safe, right? She's comfortable. There's a woman and there's a baby. What could go wrong? They seemed much less dangerous than some of the other people who offered to drive her that day, and she had said that she had turned down multiple rides before getting into Cameron and Janice's car. At one point, there was a vehicle full of men, and she was like, no. Something feels very off about that. I'm not going to get into that car, but Cameron knew what he was doing.
Yeah, well, in its human nature, I think, for a woman to see another woman and be like, okay, this is safe.
Yep.
But it's not.
No.
And it wasn't.
Once they were all traveling, it's said that friendly conversation ensued. At first, nothing seemed too off, but then Colleen kept catching Cameron's eye in the rearview mirror. Something was off. A bad feeling started creeping up in her gut. During the drive, they stopped at a gas station and Colleen went inside to use the restroom. She later said, quote, "A voice told me to run and jump out the window and never look back," end quote. She felt like she was overreacting and that she was being paranoid, so she ended up calming herself down and going back out to the Hooker's vehicle. When she got back in, she noticed that there was a box sitting next to the spot that she had been in, a box that had not been there before. About 20 minutes after they left the gas station, the Hookers mentioned a sightseeing attraction that they were not far from. They had said it was some kind of like grand ice caves and they were raving about it. They wanted to make a quick stop there. And Colleen obviously had no position to be like, no, you can't do that. She just wanted to get to her friend's house, but she was getting a ride from these people, so she couldn't be super demanding. So she just went along with it. She was making good time and she would be done and out of their van sooner than later.
Cameron ended up veering off the highway to go to those ice caves, driving down a remote, desolate dirt road that ended up taking them to the middle of nowhere with no ice caves in sight. Cameron brought the car to a stop, and Janice and their baby got out of the car. Cameron got out, seemingly disappeared, and then all of a sudden he was there holding a knife to Colleen's throat. He told her to put her hands above her head and asked her if she would comply with whatever he said, and she froze. She ended up saying yes, because what else do you do in that situation? And then he proceeded to handcuff, blindfold, bind, and gag her. Cameron placed something over Colleen's head after he finished securing her in her spot. It was a large box with metal hinges made out of plywood. It had double walls and a neck hole that was suffocating. The interior had carpet in it, which didn't help the fact that she could barely breathe inside of the box. Cameron then placed something heavy over Colleen, which she later said felt like it could have been her sleeping bag that she was traveling with. The car then started back up, and they were back out on the road, taking Colleen to her own version of hell inside Cameron and Janice Hooker's home. Not before, though, Cameron stopped the car so he and Janice could eat burgers from a fast food place on the way home. After all, they couldn't very well bring Colleen into their home while the sun was still up. Especially not with the metal-hinged box suffocating her. That would definitely draw a bit of attention. Once they were back at Cameron and Janice's home, Colleen was led out of the vehicle, up steps, and through a kitchen. Her blindfold had the slightest of gaps, and she could see what she knew to be either a refrigerator or a stove as she was being led further into the home. After going down a short flight of stairs that was also very steep, she realized she was in a basement or a cellar of sorts. Janice must have been tending to the baby because it was only Colleen and Cameron down in the basement. He told her to, quote, stand up here, as he placed her on top of a green and white Coleman cooler. After she was up on the cooler, Cameron unlocked one of her wrists and then hooked her handcuffs around a pipe, locking them again so she would be securely in place. So she was now standing on the chest and her arms were above her head. Colleen knew the minute he took her jeans off of her that things were going to get very dark. And honestly, she probably knew that before that, like when that knife was held to her throat, but part of her just didn't want to believe it. Cameron took her shirt off as well and switched out the handcuffs for leather bands. After securing them around Colleen's wrists, he hooked the leather to the ceiling with her arms spread in a V shape. Before Colleen could even get her bearings again, she felt a jolt underneath her and realized the cooler was gone. Pain radiated up and down her arms as she began to dangle, suspended from the straps around her wrists.
Colleen knew that the chances of anyone realizing that she'd been taken were slim. Her family in California had no idea she'd left Oregon. Her roommates in Oregon thought that she was hitchhiking to her friend's house, and they expected her to be gone for a few days. And the friend that she was going to see didn't even know she was coming. It was a surprise. So it was like the perfect storm.
Mm-hmm.
So just imagine being in that position where no one would even miss you for at least several days, like critical timing in an investigation that didn't happen and wasn't happening. And even then, it was the 70s. There weren't cell phone pings or digital footprints or even CCTV. Things were bleak. After the Coleman cooler was kicked out from under her, almost immediately, Cameron started whipping her, hitting both her back and her stomach, leaving painful welts in his wake. When Cameron had finished his brutal attack, he went to work, making noise around her in the basement. He pulled something over toward Colleen, something for her to stand on. She was able to just barely stand on her tiptoes to ease the intense pain in her arms. Not long after this, Cameron and Janice were having sex at her feet on the ground, right in front of where she was suspended. They finished, and Janice went back upstairs, closing the door behind her. Cameron came for Colleen again, ripping the support out from under her feet. This was the start of him kind of testing her, or honestly trying to break her, and Colleen decided not to kick or thrash around this time, and so he brought the cooler back for her to stand on. After this, Cameron unhooked Colleen from her bindings and took her down. He walked her across the room and into a box. The box was roughly only 3 feet high, with one end open. Now, he pushed her into this box, face first, so that her back was toward him. He tied her wrists with chains this time, and then he locked those chains to the top of the box. It's kind of hard to say and to imagine, but she was in a very confined place, and everything was bound together and mm-hmm. tied to something.
Yeah.
Colleen was literally caged inside of this contraption that he had made. And to make things worse, Cameron removed the leather gag he'd placed on her and replaced it with that head box from earlier.
Mm.
Colleen could not move her head. She couldn't move her body. And the head box was so tight around her neck that she was being choked. She couldn't breathe. And her natural response, obviously, was to panic, making things even worse. She thrashed around, but all she could move were her legs, so she kicked and kicked, but then Cameron bound her ankles with cords and tied them to the side of the box, and so now she's just completely immobilized. Mm. So after this, Cameron leaves, and during this time, Colleen did whatever she could to try and free herself, but she couldn't do much. She tried, but there just wasn't a whole lot that she could do. She couldn't tell if anyone would even be able to hear her muffled screams, and it turns out they wouldn't have been able to. She banged her feet on the side of the box with as much force as she could, but it wasn't much because they were tied there. She was just hoping to, knock something loose or maybe get a neighbor near to hear her. Anything. But before she knew it, Cameron was back. He opened the head box and asked her, quote, "Why the hell are you making so much noise?" End quote.
Why the hell do you think, Cameron?
Right.
What kind of question is that?
Colleen told him that she couldn't breathe and she begged him to let her out because she was in excruciating pain. Cameron's response was to close the head box back up again, grab some other contraption, and fasten that around her chest so that it completely dug into her ribs. If it wasn't hard enough to breathe already, now Colleen could barely expand her lungs at all. Cameron then put a bristly object between her legs. She couldn't tell what it was then, but this object was another one of Cameron's little inventions, an electrical contraption that he would use to shock her. He must have done a piss-poor job designing it, though, because it didn't work, at least not that time. So Cameron closed the box once more and left Colleen there to suffer by herself, all alone in the darkness, believing that she was going to die.
The next morning, Cameron came downstairs and took Colleen out of the box. He laid her down on the other side of the room with the head box still on. He chained her up there on the rack, and he left her there until that evening when he brought her some food. She was allowed to feed herself with the chains still around her wrists and blindfolded. After she ate, he suspended her from the ceiling once again. And this started kind of a routine. He would bring her food, he'd let her use a bedpan, he would chain her up here or there on the rack, from the ceiling, in the box. Usually the head box would be on her unless she was eating, and speaking of eating, if Colleen couldn't eat the food due to her circumstances, I mean, I wouldn't have much of an appetite either.
No.
But if she didn't finish her food, Cameron would take it as her being ungrateful, and he would punish her by whipping. He barely spoke to her during this time, though, and when she would ask him when he was going to let her go, he would always say, "Pretty soon." Colleen had one meal a day. She was alone for the majority of the time. She was sensory deprived. She was naked. She was brutalized, tortured, restrained. She didn't know what time it was or what day it was. She was completely and utterly helpless. After some time, Colleen's roommates back in Eugene, Oregon, were starting to wonder where she was. The time frame she'd initially given them for her trip had come and gone. She told them that she'd be back on Saturday, May 21st, and she never showed up. Alice, her roommate in Eugene, had kind of just figured that Colleen decided to go down to Riverside while she was there to see her family and catch up, so Alice waited a few more days. On Monday, May 23rd, when she still hadn't heard from Colleen, Alice decided to call Colleen's mom just to be sure. Alice knew the name of Colleen's friend, Linda Smith, but she didn't have a phone number or any other information on her, so she figured Colleen's mom would be the best bet. But when she called Colleen's mother and realized that she hadn't heard or seen from Colleen either, Alice knew something was very wrong. She contacted the Westwood Police Department, who in turn contacted Linda Smith, and Linda said that she hadn't seen Colleen, and Colleen had never come to see her. On Wednesday, May 25th, Alice finally contacted the Eugene, Oregon police to file a missing person report. This is the description that was given in the report. Colleen Jean Stan, date of birth 12/31/56, white female, 5'6", 135 pounds, long brown hair, blue eyes, freckles. Last seen wearing gray t-shirt, blue jeans, plaid jacket, brown shoes, has a sleeping bag, sweater, and purse. Unfortunately, this missing person report didn't seem to do a damn thing. It was filed, sure, but no tips came in, and the police didn't search for Colleen because they had no reason to believe anything bad happened to her. And really, there simply wasn't any evidence to be found that would lead to Colleen's whereabouts.
So, from an outsider's perspective, Cameron and Janice seemed to be living a normal life. They had their baby to take care of. Cameron worked his day job at the lumber yard. Janice ignored the woman being held captive in the basement. You know, just normal stuff. It's actually said that Janice was afraid of Colleen. Not particularly afraid that she was breaking the law, but afraid of Colleen. According to the perfect victim, when she did go down and check on Colleen during the day, Janice would take a shotgun with her, just in case. In the meantime, Cameron was cooking up something else entirely, because nothing was ever quite good enough for him. No, he always needed more. Amidst Colleen's foul routine of whippings, assaults, and isolation, Cameron started to work on something in the basement. Colleen could hear him hammering and sawing, and she realized that he was building something. Something big. After about 10 days, the project was complete, and it was another box. But this time, the box was about 3 feet tall by 6.5 feet long, with a lid on top that could open. The box was double-walled, though, making the inside quite a bit smaller, kind of like a coffin. Cameron put Colleen into this new box without the head box or the gag, just a blindfold. He made her lay down in it. On top of her, he put her sleeping bag and chained her neck, wrists, and ankles. As if that wasn't enough, he put earplugs into her ears. He closed the lid, locking Colleen inside. She was alone in that dank basement, far from home, terrified, alone, and in pain, and she would remain Cameron Hooker's captive for 7 years.
And that is where we're going to end it today.
That concludes part one. But don't you fret, there will be a part two.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to the story, you guys.
Yeah,
there's
so much. Literally the tip of the iceberg.
There's an entire book about it. Mm-hmm. There's so many different articles and things online. There's so much information. And I just really can't get over the girl in the box thing. I hate that.
I know.
I wish that everyone, like, and so many podcasts mm-hmm. have it named that. So many YouTube videos.
It feels like such a clickbaity thing. And I know that that was the name for her case, whatever, before the internet even was a thing. But it just feels like the 1970s version of clickbait.
Yeah.
Right?
It feels to me like we're kind of like undermining her.
Mm-hmm.
She has a name. She, you know, if you don't know by now, she survived. This is a survival story. And to call it something like that just really rubs me the wrong way.
It just really cheapens.
Yeah. What she went through.
Everything. Yeah.
7 years of horror.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we'll get into this next episode, but I really have a lot of conflicting feelings about Janice.
Yeah.
We'll get into that next time.
So if you need a little bit of a palate cleanser or something to lighten the mood a little bit, you can stick around after the music and we're going to be doing our reading, watching, listening. But for now, if you don't give a shit about that, you can email us at cruelandunusualthepod@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at cruelandunusualthepod.
I tweet.
At
cruelunusualpod.
And you can join us in our Facebook group.
Come on. Join us.
Our Facebook group is cruelandunusual:the group. So come hang out in there and we will catch you later. We should have a little jingle for reading, watching, listening. What are you reading, watching, listening to.
Ow!
What have you been doing?
I've been doing a lot of work.
Yeah.
If it's not like the day job stuff, it's the editing stuff. If it's not the editing stuff, it's the formatting stuff. If it's not the formatting stuff, then it's the writing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or the baby, you know, she's around.
She's living there life. In the background.
She's hanging out. But aside from work, I have been reading, watching, and listening a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have been reading, I mean, like my books that I read for work, obviously, to like edit.
Right.
So the main thing that I've been reading is The Perfect Victim, which is the book that we primarily use for today.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching Sons of Anarchy because...
Do you know that in our very first episode... Sons of Anarchy was my reading, watching, listening.
Really?
And I told you that you had to watch it. Yeah.
I know that you've been trying to get me to listen or to watch it forever. Mm-hmm. And I did try one time.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a huge fan. I watched maybe like 15 minutes of the first episode.
You're using it for kind of research too. And entertainment. I mean, it is. It's like a soap opera on a motorcycle with blood.
Truly is.
You know?
It's got all the things that you need to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to write a motorcycle club romance.
It sounded like you said, I'm trying to ride a motorcycle.
I'm trying to ride a motorcycle.
She's trying to get
guys.
Licensed.
Any tips? No, I'm trying to write a motorcycle club romance series. So I need to like read some, watch some things before I can like pretend like I know what I'm doing. So I've been watching that. I think I'm on like season one, episode 12.
Oh my God.
Uh-huh. Every night before bed.
Wow.
Every night before bed.
Yeah.
And sometimes in the morning, depending on how much anxiety I have when mm-hmm. I wake up. I've also been listening to a few pods. I want to listen to that one that you talked about. What is it? It was like one long episode.
Oh, The Ghostwriter.
That's right.
That one was good.
I do want to listen to The Ghostwriter.
I'll tell them a little bit about that really quick in case you're not in the Facebook group, because I know I talked about it in there. But it's a podcast. It's only one episode that's like an hour and a half long, and it's marketed as kind of like a movie, but in podcast form. And it's fiction. And it's about a woman who becomes a ghostwriter for a billionaire, like writing his book, and things get real weird, a little creepy, kind of scary.
I really want to listen to it.
So it's not a big commitment either, is what I liked. It's only like one.
Right. Also, while we were on our little hiatus, I listened to the entire like series that was The Officer's Wife.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very in-depth, thorough good look of the case of Jessica Boynton and her husband, Matthew Boynton. I feel like you guys would really like that.
Yeah.
And that's so that's called The Officer's Wife.
I listened to that one, too. It's very intriguing.
Mm-hmm. And it's still it's like open ended,
mm-hmm.
even though everyone kind of knows what happened, but we don't know what happened.
Right.
You know,
we don't know how everything got to that point.
Exactly. And we probably never will. But I think that that's all I've really been reading, watching, listening to. What about you, though? Wait. Also,
what?
There's more.
Oh, but wait.
I also watched The Girl in the Box, like the movie that was based on the Colleen Stan case. There was a lot of like little things that were different than what actually happened because it was loose. Kind of. I shouldn't say.
Well, it's not a documentary, right?
No,
it's with
it's
actors.
Like a movie.
Yeah.
Right. It's like an actual movie with actors. And so a lot of little things have been changed, like the car and like, you know, just having the baby, not having the baby at certain times. But yeah, it's hard to watch. It really is hard to watch. It doesn't like show firsthand like the beatings and the whippings and the abuse, but you know that it's happening in the background.
Yeah.
So I would say if those kinds of things are triggering for you like they are for me, I would skip it.
Yeah.
Especially because you're listening to it now. I wouldn't recommend watching it unfold, too, if that's hard for you. Anyway, enough about me, ma'am. What are you reading, watching, listening to? Was that good?
That was great. So I did read quite a few books during our hiatus, and I'm just going to talk about my favorites.
Yes, bitch.
Probably my most favorite one that I read is called If I Disappear, and that's by Eliza Jane Brazier. Brazier, maybe. I don't know. But it was really good. It's about a true crime podcast host who goes missing and her number one fan trying to find her, and I'm not going to tell you anything else. But I really, really enjoyed that one.
You talked about that one a lot with me. Yeah. So I know that you enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good.
And just then, to give you some, you know, reiteration that, yeah, that you enjoyed it, Katie.
Just in case you didn't know, it was good. And I thought it was good. Okay.
And it was good, damn it. Read it.
And plus, it was good. All right. My other favorite was No Exit by Taylor Adams. And that's about the girl who gets stranded in a snowstorm at a rest area in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, it gets really, really bad. She ends up finding a little girl in a cage in the back of a truck, back of a van.
I've seen that book for a long time and always meant to read it, and I just never do. So I really need to read that one this year.
Very intense. That's the kind of book that you don't want to put down. You just want to keep going and stay up all night. But it's also very, very gory.
Very. So. Oh, why? I'm agreeing. I've read it.
it's really gory. Just in case you
didn't hear me. We're very good at giving each other, you know.
We're not really very good at anything. Like, that's the problem.
God.
Okay. Podcast I listen to, Lime Town. I've been into the fiction podcast. I made you listen to that one, and I think you thought it was real at first. And you're like, how did this happen? I never heard about it. I'm like, Tori, it didn't happen. It's not a thing.
So I started watching the Jessica Biel series.
Yeah.
Like months ago. And it, you know, I never finish anything I start. So that fell off the face of the earth. And then when you brought up the podcast, I was like, oh my God, that was so intriguing. I need to actually, like, you know, listen. And I'm driving all day. So like, why not?
Yeah.
And then I started getting real invested in it. I was like, oh fuck. Like how, this is so wild. So I text Katie. I'm like, how? My mind cannot wrap around it. And she's like, well, because it there's nothing to wrap around. And I'm like, oh.
Well, dumb. That makes sense then. It's a good, intriguing story. It's a little bit sci-fi-ish.
Yeah.
A little bit. But
which is
good.
Why my brain couldn't really wrap around
it. Yeah. I stuck it through. I finished it pretty good. Another fiction one that I binged is called Dark Woods. That's by the guy that does...
Is it Vin Diesel?
Not CSI. No, it's not Vin Diesel. My God. That does Law and Order. Dick Wolf.
Is that his name?
Dick Wolf.
Oh.
Or is it Fox? Wolf, no. Or Fox? God. Man. This wow. is bad. Wow. That's good. That's another fiction one. Not true crime. It can't be true crime if it's a fiction. But it's like a crime story. Mm-hmm. And I haven't been watching really anything. I don't do a lot of TV. But I did watch the Starved Rock Murders documentary on HBO.
I meant to watch that and I didn't.
Yeah, it's like a 3-part series. My favorite was at the very beginning. The Starved Rock Murders it was 3 women in the 1960s who were murdered at Starved Rock, which is a state park. And at the very beginning, so the guy who made the show is the person who prosecuted Chester Uyghur. It's his son. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, this is going to be biased, yeah. You know, but it wasn't.
Huh.
Not at all.
And I'm surprised.
Yeah. But at the very beginning, he's driving and he's on the phone with somebody and he's telling him the legend of Starved Rock, why it's called that. Mm-hmm. And the guy on the phone's like, I heard that was kind of a myth. And he's like, I think all of LaSalle County is kind of a myth. I'm like, there's never been a more true statement. I lived there for a long time. And actually where this happened at was pretty close to where they found Jelani Day.
Yeah, it was not very far from there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I really do want to cover that case soon, yeah. Sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Now, is that all you have?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, because I did want to read one review that I saw that was posted while we were on hiatus, and it was from October 17th of 2021.
Is it the one star?
Yeah. And it says, really liked the show, but suddenly there aren't any more coming and nothing has been said about it. Just curious. And they gave us one star. And I'm just saying, like, you really liked it. But you really liked it, though.
Yeah.
I get
whoa, shit.
Like being bummed because we were gone. I mean, we had to do that for ourselves. And we did talk about it a lot on social media.
Yeah.
But we didn't say it like in an episode because everything happened very quickly.
Yeah.
However, if you liked the show.
You can edit that, maybe. You don't have to. You know what? Your stars are your stars. You can own your stars.
I just thought that was funny that whoever it was really liked it, but it was only one star.
Well, hopefully you came back.
So, yeah, hopefully they come back and listen.
Come see us again sometime.
But then there was another one. There was one that gave us 5 stars, and I thought that was really nice. That was from only a few days from before that. It was October 13th. And this person labeled it the best.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. The best. Me? We've never been described as the best. But it
at
says,
anything.
I love turning this on whenever I'm in the car and listening to the topic of the day. I've learned so much about different murders or situations I've never before. Plus, I enjoy listening to the ladies say you're funny for effing sure. I was like, wow. People, someone, what, really? Aww. Are you sure? Is this the right podcast? But yeah, anyway, thank you for that review.
Yes, thanks. And
for the one who gave us the one star, I hope that you're okay. And I hope that you realize that we came back and maybe you want to listen to us and maybe not. And that's OK.
Maybe you don't trust us now because maybe you think we're going to fall off. And maybe we will. To be quite honest, you're justified.
You never know.
But I saw that and I just thought it was funny. Yeah. So you guys, this is really the first time that we've actually talked to you since coming back. And hopefully you guys are not too turned off by the new type of show.
Right.
That we're kind of putting out there.
We just wanted to keep our stupidity far away from these cases because they don't deserve that.
No. We have no problem coming on here and chatting and, like, you know, being the idiots that we are. But we do want to save it for after the outro music.
Yes. Yes.
Anyway, yeah. I think that's all.
I think so. Let us know you're reading, watching, listening on in the Facebook group.
Yeah.
You guys, if you ever have recommendations, just you can put them in there. You can put anything you want. Just don't be like weird.
Don't be crass.
Yeah.
Don't put things that violate Facebook's guidelines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Okay, God, okay. We're leaving. Right. Love you.
Goodbye. Love you.
Bye.